Mama was standing on the other side of the baby gate, ready for Franz's appearance. "Woof, woof, woof, woof," Franz broadcast as he nudged his way out of the bathroom and bounded through the living room and kitchen. He bounced off sofas, knocked over chairs, and skidded into moving boxes. These post-bath rampages lasted only about 10 minutes, and the Vanderbeekers knew to steer clear until Franz exhausted himself. Unfortunately, when Hyacinth let Franz loose, she did not count on someone coming home at that exact moment. The front door opened, and in walked Issa.
"Watch out!" Hyacinth yelled at Issa.
"Franz!" Mama yelled at the crazed dog. But it was too late. Mama shielded her eyes. "Woof!" barked Franz, running straight toward Issa and not stopping until he rammed right into her and knocked her down, leaving a basset hound-sized wet spot on her jacket.
"What the?"
Issa felt something inside her snap. She pushed Franz off and struggled to her feet. Franz, who now realized that knocking Issa over was one of his poorer decisions of the year, retreated slowly to Hyacinth, who stood in the bathroom doorway, still dripping. The commotion in the living room was so dramatic that the Vanderbeeker kids peeked down and watched as Issa marched to the head of the basement stairs, where Jessie had just appeared after waking up from her nap.
"You!"
Issa pointed a finger at Jessie.
"We need to talk right now!"
Issa strode out the back entrance into the yard, the door slamming behind her. Jessie was petrified. Issa had never, ever raised her voice to her like that. She felt the eyes of her family follow her as she walked through the kitchen and into the backyard. Issa stood stiffly under the old maple, her back to Jessie. Wind gusted around them, and Jessie rubbed her arms, shivering.
"I was just at Castleman's," Issa said.
Jessie gulped.
"Guess who I saw there?"
Mrs. Castleman," Jessie suggested hopefully.
"Benny!"
Issa shouted, turning to face Jessie, the wind whipping through her hair.
"He hates me, all because of you."
"I can explain, Issa. Do you have the right to make decisions for me?
You knew I wanted to go to the dance. Now Benny thinks I hate him. Why would you do this to me?"
"Issa, I thought you wouldn't want to go. Remember how I used to make fun of those dances?"
"I am not you," Issa yelled. "We are not the same person. And because of you, Benny asked someone else to the dance."
Tears ran down Issa's face. Jessie was a statue, unable to move or say a word. Issa's voice lowered.
"I want you to leave me alone. Don't speak to me. Don't speak for me. Don't make decisions for me. Don't talk to other people about me. Got it?"
Issa flew back into the apartment, and the door banged closed. Her family, who had watched the entire exchange through the windows, jumped guiltily away. Their eyes followed Issa as she stormed upstairs. When they heard her bedroom door slam, they returned to the windows to look for Jessie. Her back was to them, but they could see her shoulders hunched. Jessie stood out there for 5 minutes in the cold with no jacket before Mama joined her.
"Hey,"
Mama said, draping a coat over her. Jessie was shaking.
"Wanna talk?
Can I help?" Jessie shook her head. Mama put her arms around Jessie's waist, pulling her close, murmuring comforting words. Together they stood until Jessie began to shake so uncontrollably that Mama took her arm and guided her inside. Later that evening, Jessie went to bed on the couch. Issa had made it clear she did not want to see Jessie that night or possibly ever again. It was the first time in their lives that the twins hadn't slept in the same room. Sensing that she needed companionship, George Washington curled at Jessie's side and did not once attack her feet. Paganini lay on the floor at the foot of the couch, nose twitching and ears pricked forward, as if on alert for danger. Tears leaked from Jessie's eyes and soaked into her pillow as she stared at the ceiling, counting the number of times she heard ambulance sirens blare down the avenue en route to the hospital. She counted 8 before she settled into a troubled sleep. A few hours later, she awoke to see her father dozing on the floor next to Paganini.
"Papa,"
Jessie whispered, her voice rough with sleep and tears.
"Moral support," he said, "in case you need me."
Jessie closed her eyes again as more tears rolled down her cheeks. Upstairs, Issa had yet to fall asleep. Her mind buzzed with thoughts of her sister and Benny and eighth-grade dances and long, pale-pink dresses and corsages. The thoughts merged into the Biedermann and their brownstone in her basement, and Issa felt so lonely and lost that she didn't know how their mission to win him over could possibly succeed. After another hour of tossing, Issa remembered the envelope Mrs. Castleman had given her. She got out of bed and dug through her bag to find it. As she opened the envelope, a yellowed newspaper clipping fluttered to the ground. Issa quickly scanned the article and felt her heart stretch tight. She slipped the newspaper clipping back into the envelope and stuck it between 2 books on her bookshelf. Then she left her room and crept down the hall to her parents' room. Mama was sleeping alone in the bed. Issa got under the covers and curled in next to her. Mama opened her eyes.
"Hi, sweetie," she murmured.
"Mama,"
Issa said, rubbing her chest where her heart lay underneath.
"Everything hurts."
"I know, sweetie," Mama said, stroking her hair. "I know."
When Issa finally drifted off an hour later, the brownstone groaned with relief as the last Vanderbeeker fell into a fitful sleep. Local mother and daughter killed in Harlem motorist accident. Abigail Biedermann, 42, and her daughter Luciana Biedermann, 16, were crossing the street at 137th Street and Convent Avenue when they were struck by a cab, said police. They were 5 blocks away from their Harlem home. The driver, David Albertson, sustained minor injuries. "A cab came speeding around the corner," said Helene Castleman, a local baker, who witnessed the accident in front of her business. "It was a horrible scene." The victims were rushed to Harlem Hospital, where Abigail Biedermann was pronounced dead. Luciana Biedermann died from injuries later that evening. The driver was released from the hospital, and police are investigating whether he was driving while intoxicated. No arrests have been made. Chapter 18. Jessie's eyes flew open. It took her a few moments to register her father snoring on the floor and George Washington kneading the blanket draped over her. Paganini hopped circles around Papa and nudged Papa's feet with his nose, ready to start the day. Jessie put her hand on her heart and rubbed.
Today was Christmas Eve.
Papa emitted a powerful snore and woke himself up.
What? Grab the coats,
he said, bolting upright. He looked around, confused, then saw Jessie staring down at him.
Oh, hey, sweetie. Sorry about that. Was I snoring?
Yes, Papa.
Did I say weird things in my dreams?
Yes, Papa.
They got up, folded the blankets, and started preparing breakfast. Jessie retrieved her list of things to do for Christmas Eve dinner and examined it while listening to the sounds of her family awakening upstairs. Her stomach was full of knots, and she waited for Issa to come down. First, Lainey appeared, wearing her panda coat and talking to her stuffed bunny about what presents she wanted for Christmas. Oliver stumbled into the kitchen next, his hair in disarray. Jessie felt Oliver's eyes settle on her as she pretended to review the dinner menu.
"Mama's going to help you make dinner, right?"
Oliver asked her.
"I don't know,"
Jessie adjusted her glasses. Probably not.
I think she should. It's Christmas Eve dinner,
Oliver reminded her, perhaps unwisely.
I think you should be quiet, Jessie snapped.
Papa spoke up.
Oliver, my beloved son.
Only son, Jessie grumbled under her breath.
This would be a good time to give your sister some space, Papa finished.
Oliver shrugged and tried not to think too hard about what he had said wrong. He knew he would never understand. Hyacinth came downstairs with Franz at her heels, followed by Mama's light footsteps. At last, Jessie heard the last set of familiar footfalls. Out of the corner of her eye, she watched Issa make her way into the kitchen. Issa picked up Lainey and settled her on her hip, greeting everyone except Jessie. Jessie dared to look up at her sister. "What time do you want to start cooking?" she asked.
"Whenever,"
Issa replied, avoiding her glance, as she kissed Lainey's nose and put her down on the floor. Jessie tapped her pencil against her dinner notes. She felt uncharacteristically apprehensive.
"Should we split up the list? I can make the beef stew and the cheesecake. Do you want to do the roasted vegetables and carrot cake?"
"Fine."
"If you'd rather do the beef stew, I can do the roasted vegetables."
"Whatever."
Jessie hesitated.
"Does that mean you want to do the beef stew, or do you want to make the roasted vegetables?"
"I don't care."
Issa turned away from Jessie to grab a mug from the cupboard.
"So we should stick with the original plan?"
"Fine!"
Issa whipped around and glared at Jessie. Then she turned her glare to Oliver and Hyacinth, who had been spectators to the entire exchange, their gazes bouncing back and forth.
"Well,"
Hyacinth said to no one in particular,
"looks like Franz wants to visit the kittens in the backyard."
She grabbed a snoozing Franz by the collar and dragged him outside. Oliver's delivery was equally unbelievable.
"Yeah, gotta run. Going to, organize my bookshelves."
He trailed off, then scurried up the stairs two at a time.
"Listen," Mama said, one hand braced on Issa's shoulder and the other braced on Jessie's.
"We can see that you two are working something out. However, 7 hungry adults and 3 hungry kids are counting on you for dinner tonight. Papa and I will take the kids down the street to help wrap gifts for the toy drive, so we'll be out of your hair. Are you two going to be okay? Should we think about a plan B?"
"We can do it,"
Issa muttered. Jessie nodded mutely. The day couldn't be over soon enough. An hour later, the Vanderbeekers' home was eerily quiet. While the rest of the family was at PS 737 school cafeteria wrapping gifts for the toy drive, Issa and Jessie went about their dinner preparations without a word, every sound echoing throughout the kitchen. Jessie retrieved her beef stew instructions mechanically. Her stomach felt squeamish and unsteady. The last time she had felt like this was when she ate the fish head stew Allegra's mom had made. "It does amazing things for your kidneys," Allegra's mom, the pediatrician, had said. "Even if I throw it all up," Jessie had thought, but not said. Jessie chopped the onions, carrots, celery, and garlic, put them in a bowl, lined up her seasonings, turned the burner on, added olive oil to the pot. Threw in the vegetables, then beef, then broth, stirred, waited. Issa was doing her own chopping on the kitchen counter, her knife pounding against the scarred cutting board. Potatoes, mushrooms, bell peppers, and carrots were all dumped together in a roasting pan with olive oil, salt, and pepper. Issa set the oven to 400 degrees, shoved the roasting pan inside, and let the oven door bang closed. Then she stomped downstairs to the basement. Soon after, Jessie heard the sounds of Issa's bow striking her violin in a moody rendition of La Folia.
Jesse collapsed onto a kitchen stool, arms crossed on the counter, head buried in her arms. She stayed there, unmoving, while the steam rattled the lid on the soup pot up and down, up and down. Hyacinth was the first one out of the school when the Vanderbeekers were done with their gift wrapping. The second she got home, she leashed up Franz and was back outside before her family had even made it inside. "Franz and I are going to hang out in the backyard. See you later. Bye," Hyacinth blurted out. No one questioned her, even though it was 35 degrees and the trees lining the sidewalk bent against the strain of the wind. "Franz, listen up. It's time for our secret spy mission." First, they stopped by the alley, where Papa kept the gray trash cans and blue recycling bins. Hyacinth sifted through a stack of boxes Mama had deemed too small to be useful for the move. After choosing the perfect one, Hyacinth and Franz made their way to the hydrangea bush in the corner of the backyard, just beyond the big oak. Underneath the bush was a family of cats. Hyacinth had been feeding the Mama, a sleek black cat she had named Francesca Priscilla Arlington, for the last 2 months, and had salvaged a small wooden cabinet abandoned on the sidewalk for her to live in after she gave birth to her litter 6 weeks ago. The cabinet was lined with old fuzzy blankets Hyacinth had procured from Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet. Franz tilted his head, and one ear twitched. He stuck his face inside the cabinet and nuzzled the three kittens, who responded by batting his nose playfully. Hyacinth stroked Francesca Priscilla Arlington and leaned down to kiss her head. For a moment, Hyacinth's resolve faltered. But then, as if her father were right next to her, whispering in her ear, Hyacinth remembered something. "Until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened." Hyacinth took a deep breath, then lifted the little black kitten with the smudges of white fur on her paws out of the cabinet. "We're going to take real good care of your baby," Hyacinth whispered to Francesca Priscilla Arlington. She placed the kitten in the box, removed her own scarf, a rainbow-colored piece she had knitted herself, and tucked it around the kitten. Kitten and box in hand, Hyacinth led the way out of the alley and back up the brownstone's front stairs. She entered the first-floor hallway, crept along the walls on tiptoe, and looped the end of Franz's leash to the doorknob that led to their apartment. She kissed Franz on his cold nose. "You must be very, very quiet," she whispered to him. Franz looked back into her hazel eyes, and Hyacinth knew in her soul that he understood the importance of this moment. Hyacinth commenced the final stage of her super spy mission. Up she went to the third floor with the box in her arms. Her hands shook when she laid the box in front of the Biedermann's door. She clenched a trembling hand into a fist, paused only slightly, then banged on the door. Down two flights of stairs, she flew, before grabbing Franz's leash off the door handle and disappearing into her apartment. The sound of her pounding heart so filled her ears that she couldn't tell whether the door on the third floor had opened or not. Chapter 19. The entire Vanderbeeker family was sprawled around the living room when Papa's cell phone rang. He answered it, and the kids abruptly quieted when they heard him say,
"Hello, Mr. Biedermann, how are you?"
There was a pause, then, "Oh, really? The last 2 mornings? I had no idea." Papa cast a "you have a lot of explaining to do" look in the kids' direction, while Mama leaned in close to the phone. The Vanderbeeker kids gave each other uneasy glances before backing up in the direction of the stairs.
"I'm very surprised," Papa continued, glaring at his kids. "That doesn't sound like them. You saw them out your window?"
"I see.
I will definitely talk with them. That is completely unacceptable, and I'm very sorry.
Papa's glare at his retreating children intensified as he pointed one stern finger at them, then to a spot on the ground, 1 foot away from him.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Biedemann. The sudden move has been hard on them. I'm sure you can understand that.
The kids arrived at the designated spot in front of Papa and stared at the ground.
Yes, of course.
We will be out by December 31st, maybe earlier. Again, I'm sorry, Mr. Biedemann. I hope you have a happy
Papa stopped and looked down at the phone screen.
The man just hung up on me, Papa muttered.
He set his phone on top of a side table, then turned slowly to face the kids.
Anything you want to tell me? Papa asked, looking at each of his kids.
No one said anything.
That was Mr. Biedemann, Papa said. He told me about a petition that you kids put together.
He's very, very upset.
Issa twisted her fingers together.
Jessie looked straight ahead at a crack in the brownstone wall. Oliver's eyes darted to each of his siblings in panic. Hyacinth's eyes filled with tears as she reached down to stroke Franz's ears. Lainey was the only one looking up at Papa with glum brown eyes.
Mr. Biedemann is furious, not only about the petition, but because someone, and from the way he described her, it sounded like it might be your friend Allegra, figured out his phone number and circulated it throughout the neighborhood.
The twins grimaced while Papa continued.
People have been calling him all day, demanding that he renew our lease. He had to disconnect his phone.
Hyacinth held her breath, waiting for Papa to bring up the kitten. But he didn't.
Oliver spoke up. We thought it would encourage him to let us stay if he knew how many people loved us in the neighborhood, he explained.
I know you kids love the brownstone. Your mama and I love it, too. But you cannot do things like this. It's hurtful to Mr. Biedemann, and I expect you all to apologize. You will each write him a note and slide it under his door. Please do not disturb him anymore.
The petition was my idea, Issa said, a flush covering her cheeks. We didn't know Allegra would have people call him, she added quickly. I just wanted to show the Biedemann how important this place is to us.
I can see how the petition was wrong. I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry.
Issa looked at her siblings.
Hyacinth's face was pale. Lainey was openly crying. Jessie was yanking at a loose thread on her T-shirt, and Oliver was grinding the toe of his sneaker into the wooden floor.
Issa took a deep breath.
We have something else to tell you, Issa said.
Oliver looked at her in panic and shook his head briskly.
Issa glanced away from him.
We did something else.
Papa dropped his head as if he couldn't handle more bad news. Mama sighed and crossed her arms over her chest.
We sent away a man who came to look at our apartment, Issa said in a whisper.
I told him he was walking in the wrong direction. Oliver jumped in. But I didn't feel good about it.
There was a long pause while Papa and Mama communicated with their eyes.
This is a fine mess, Papa finally said. Not only are you getting extra chores next week, but you will each write a letter of apology to Mr. Biedemann, and you will also confess what you did with the prospective tenant. In person.
Papa,
protested Jessie.
No.
No excuses, Mama said. We're disappointed in you.
Okay, Papa, said Issa, her voice trembling.
I'll make sure we apologize right.
She felt the weight of failure hang heavy on her, failing to convince the Biedemann that they were worth keeping, failing to hold on to their home, failing her parents, failing, failing, failing.
Papa finally broke the silence. I know this has been hard on you kids, he said. I wish I could have.
He paused and shook his head. And instead of finishing his sentence,
He opened his arms and Issa fell into him, sobs pouring out of her.
After a moment, the other kids and Mama gathered in, mourning all the things they could not hold on to.
The Vanderbeeker kids headed upstairs to Issa and Jesse's bedroom, where the only sound was the rattle of the windows in their frames from the winter winds. Issa still refused to look at or speak to Jesse. Hyacinth helped Lainey write, "I'm sorry, love Lainey," before writing her own apology letter. Jesse watched Issa slip the CD she had made for the Biederman into an envelope. When everyone was done, they trudged upstairs. Hyacinth was relieved to see that the kitten and the box were gone. The Vanderbeeker kids took turns sliding their letters of apology under the door. Oliver pushed through Mr. Rochester's business card last. A sticky note was attached to the card with a hasty scribble on it that said, "He's the right guy for the brownstone."
"Who's ready for Christmas?"
Auntie Harrigan and Uncle Arthur were waiting in the living room with huge smiles, tinsel draped around their necks, and Santa hats on their heads, when the Vanderbeekers returned from their trip to the Biederman's apartment. Auntie Harrigan had altered her hair again. This time it was dyed bright red and cut super short and spiky. Uncle Arthur had grown a grizzly beard and was wearing a plaid flannel work shirt with paint-splattered jeans. They were holding piles of presents, all wrapped decadently in striped paper and abundant ribbons. The kids tried their best to look happy.
"I must admit," said Auntie Harrigan as she pulled the kids in for a hug, "I'm not used to such glum reactions when you kids see me. Did I forget someone's birthday? Miss an important dance concert? Or basketball game?"
The kids shook their heads, then one by one, they told her the story of the Biederman and the move. Auntie Harrigan, who had already heard about their impending move from Papa, sat herself down on a cardboard box full of packed books and listened to every word. After the kids finished, there was a prolonged period of silence while Auntie Harrigan chewed on her lip, deep in thought. The kids watched her, hoping she might have the perfect solution for them. Finally, Auntie Harrigan sighed.
"I'm sorry, kids. I wish I knew how to help you, but I'm very, very proud of you. I think those nice things you did for Mr. Biederman were meaningful to him, even if it doesn't seem like it."
The kids nodded, unbelieving. Auntie Harrigan stood up and clapped her hands.
"If it's going to be the last Christmas Eve dinner here, we better make it really, really great. Your mom told me that you ladies," she smiled at the twins, "are cooking for us tonight. What a treat."
Oliver mimed gagging motions that everyone ignored. The twins went back to dinner preparations, while Auntie Harrigan taught the other kids how to draw armadillos. Franz, excited about the visitors and the general chaotic state of the apartment, could not keep still. After he drooled on her drawing multiple times, Lainey took charge.
"Franz, come," she said sternly,
jabbing her finger at the floor next to him. Franz ignored her. He only answered to Hyacinth. Paganini, however, bolted from his shoebox and skidded to a stop at Lainey's feet.
"Good boy,"
Lainey said to her bunny, thrilled. Auntie Harrigan's jaw dropped.
"Does that bunny know commands?"
Oliver scoffed. "That bunny? His brain is the size of an acorn." Lainey looked like she was either going to protest or burst into tears, but she was saved from both when Mama entered the living room with an announcement.
"I just got off the phone with Miss Josie," Mama called out. "Change of plans. We're going to gather in their apartment for dinner. We thought it would be easier, given..."
Mama gestured at the mess of boxes stacked in unstable piles throughout the living room. Auntie Harrigan accompanied Mama to the second floor to help set up, while Papa and Uncle Arthur carried up a long folding table, followed by a dozen folding chairs. Lainey put Paganini in his carrier, detained only briefly by Mama, who unsuccessfully tried to make a case that Paganini would be more comfortable at home.
The twins went to their room to change clothes. When Uncle Arthur came down to retrieve more chairs, he caught Oliver examining the food.
"What's the verdict?"
he asked. Oliver knew Uncle Arthur was referring to Oliver's running tally of the twins' edible versus inedible meals. The twins were currently at a 43% success rate.
"I'm scared to try it,"
Oliver replied, poking at a piece of blackened vegetable.
"Come on, how bad could it be? When I was little, your grandma made us eat fried rabbit livers with pepper jelly. You kids have it easy. We got blackened vegetables on the good days."
Oliver dipped the ladle into the beef stew.
"I won't tell Lainey and Hyacinth that you're a rabbit killer if you eat this bite of stew, and no spitting it out."
He held the ladle up to his uncle.
"Double dog dare." "Ha!" Uncle Arthur scoffed. "Easiest dare ever."
He took the ladle from Oliver and tipped it into his mouth. There was a pause as his mouth adjusted to the taste. Then he sprinted to the sink and spit it out.
"Salty. Need water,"
he gasped, gulping water directly from the faucet spout. When he recovered, he turned to Oliver.
"You win. At least the bread's from Castleman's," Oliver offered.
"Bread and water for dinner," said Uncle Arthur, how Dickensian.
So much for their last Christmas Eve in the brownstone. Chapter 20. Issa and Jesse changed silently in their bedroom and tossed their food-spattered clothes into the laundry hamper. Outside, the wind swooshed and whistled. Issa left the room with her violin in hand, and Jesse found herself alone with her thoughts. Issa's angry words from the previous day kept running through her head. "Do you have the right to make decisions for me? We are not the same." Jesse recalled the tears running down her sister's face at the idea of Benny taking another girl to the dance. Did Issa really like Benny? What if Issa and Benny didn't reconcile before they moved? Jesse looked around their bedroom. She thought about all the nights they had stayed up late, talking in whispers and using their pillows to muffle their laughter. Jesse saw Issa's perfectly made bed and her own bed with its twisted sheets and rumpled blankets. In the corner of the room by the big window, there was a loose floorboard that the twins had pried up 5 years earlier when they were convinced that a treasure was hidden underneath. Now they used the space to stash Halloween candy before Mama confiscated it. Jesse took a deep breath. She couldn't fix the Biederman problem. She couldn't fix the moving problem. But she could try to fix the Benny problem. Mr. Van Houten, his violin case slung over his shoulder, blew into the brownstone right before dinner began, exclaiming over the severe weather. He whipped off his hat, revealing a head of unruly hair. He greeted the adults, hugged the kids, and kissed Franz right on the lips. After numerous runs up and down the stairs to retrieve food and flatware and dishes, the table was finally set. Auntie Harrigan added her own contributions to the table, a glazed ham and a flourless chocolate cake. Miss Josie set out a pot of collard greens and southern cornbread. Gloom hung heavy over the dinner table as the kids sat themselves down for their final Christmas Eve dinner in the brownstone. Papa said the blessings and thanked everyone for coming. After a round of applause for the cooks, the twins looking like they were being sentenced to a year's worth of dishwashing, everyone dug in. Oliver made a point to avoid the beef stew when it was offered to him. He surreptitiously observed everyone else as they scooped large ladlefuls into their bowls. When no one spit it out, Oliver reached across the table to ladle a small amount of the stew into his bowl, then took a tentative sip. But wait, it tasted normal. What happened to all the salt? Auntie Harrigan nudged his arm and winked.
"Amazing what a little extra water and broth can do," she whispered.
"Ah," Oliver said. He looked over at Uncle Arthur, who saluted Oliver with his soup spoon. I guess this will bump up their edible meal percentage.
Auntie Harrigan shrugged.
I do what I gotta do, she responded.
A more morose Christmas Eve dinner had never been had among the Vanderbeekers. Every window rattled ominously against the wind, which increased in severity throughout the meal. The adults provided most of the conversation, and the kids offered one-word answers whenever a question was directed at them, with the exception of Lainey, who offered a running commentary of every thought that went through her head. Dinner was not a long affair. No one had an appetite. Finally, Mr. Jeet leaned over and whispered conspiratorially to Lainey. When she nodded, Mr. Jeet called for everyone's attention.
We have a special treat for you,
Mr. Jeet announced.
Please gather around.
Lainey sought out Paganini from under the fronds of a potted palm tree. The jaunty bow tie she had tied around his neck earlier had vanished. Lainey lured Paganini out with a few carrot pieces, then led him to the center of the living room.
And now, Grand presenting the famous Paganini,
she gestured to Paganini, who was grooming his ears. The puzzled audience looked at Paganini, unsure why they were doing so.
We will now demonstrate Paganini's smartness, Lainey announced.
Oliver choked on the water he was drinking, and Uncle Arthur pounded on his back. Lainey walked over to the other side of the room, then said,
Paganini, come.
Paganini hopped over to Lainey and sat up on his hind legs. The audience clapped and nodded in appreciation, impressed that Paganini was not hard of hearing, as previously believed.
Good boy, Paganini,
Lainey exclaimed, giving him a carrot. I knew there was something funny going on with that bunny, Auntie Harrigan commented under her breath to Uncle Arthur. When the applause quieted down, Lainey began again.
And now another trick.
She walked 10 feet away from Mr. Jeet, and Paganini followed her. Mr. Jeet held an embroidery hoop 1 inch off the floor.
Paganini? Hoop!
Mr. Jeet called out. Paganini zigzagged back over to Mr. Jeet and executed a clean jump through the hoop. Mama's jaw dropped. A slow grin came over Papa's face. Even Oliver was impressed. When the room quieted, Lainey gave another command.
Paganini, lie down.
Paganini flopped on his side, an ear hanging over his eye. The audience cheered.
Last trick,
said Lainey. Mr. Jeet leaned down and placed a toy piano on the floor in front of him.
Paganini, play piano.
Paganini scrambled up from his prone position and hopped to the piano. Then he placed his front paws on the keyboard and pressed down, creating a discordant chord. And for that moment, the Vanderbeeker kids forgot their troubles and joined the adults in loud applause and cheers. Mr. Jeet and Lainey stood up together and held hands, then took a deep bow.
Encore! Encore! Papa shouted.
Jesse took one of the flowers from the vase on the dining room table and tossed it at Lainey's feet. When Paganini tried to eat it, Mr. Jeet reached down to rescue the flower and handed it to Lainey with a gallant nod. Lainey curtsied 7 times before running to Mama and jumping into her arms. There was such terrific noise following Paganini's show that at first no one noticed the persistent banging on the ceiling. Dull thuds that came in short spurts before starting again. Mama leaned over to Papa.
Do you hear that noise?
Papa, who was congratulating Mr. Jeet, paused to listen. The banging began again.
I think it's coming from upstairs, Mama said uneasily.
Issa's good mood after Lainey's bunny performance vanished. She glared at the ceiling as if she could beam lasers from her eyes and decimate the upstairs occupant. One by one, people began to glance upward.
What's that banging, Papa?
Lainey asked.
I think it's Mr. Biederman,
Miss Josie said apologetically.
He does that sometimes when people come over. I think we get a little loud for him.
Every single person in the room stared at her.
Did you say Beetlemon?
Asked Mr. Van Houten, a peculiar look on his face.
He bangs on your ceiling? Said Mama, shocked.
Down with the Beetlemon! Shouted Oliver, fist raised high above his head. Miss Josie lifted her hands helplessly, as if apologizing. The room buzzed with indignation when the banging resumed louder than ever. Isa shot out of her chair. She grabbed her violin from the console next to the front entrance, jerked the door open, and took the stairs two at a time up to the Biederman's apartment. Isa could vaguely hear her family rush out behind her, but it didn't stop her from pounding a fist on the door.
It opened with a terrific bang, as if the Biederman had been waiting for Isa to arrive.
What? The Biederman roared.
His eyes flashed, and he loomed above Isa in his midnight black clothes.
The wind howled around the brownstone. Isa, her usually tidy hair now an angry halo, pointed the tip of her violin bow 1 inch from the Biederman's cold heart.
You, Isa spoke in a low, dangerous voice. You are a terrible, grouchy, horrible person. You are mean to Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet. You were making us move for no reason, and now you are ruining our last Christmas here.
Isa pushed the hair off her shoulder and put her violin up, clenched her eyes shut, and crashed her bow onto the strings. The piece was Les Furies, and Isa's playing was harsh and unrelenting. It was as if she were dueling against her own fury and disappointment and frustration and loneliness. Around her, the brownstone braced itself against the wind and against her rage. She played because the Biederman was cruel. She played because she had disappointed her parents and failed her siblings. She played because Benny hated her. She played because they had to move out of the home they loved. She played because she was fighting with her sister and best friend, the person she loved most in the world. She played because their mission had failed, and now there was nothing else she could do. The music exploded through the brownstone, reverberating through the brick walls and making the air crackle. The brownstone shuddered and shook. Outside, the water wall was a frenzy of chimes knocking madly into each other and the sounds of crashing metal. When it seemed as if the walls themselves would start to crumble, the tension eased. Almost imperceptibly, Isa's violin gentled, as if coaxing Les Furies into submission. Then quietly, so quietly, her bow glided along the first note of the swan. If Les Furies had cleansed her heart of her rage, the swan opened up space for grace to enter in again. The wind outside eased, and the brownstone groaned with relief. Isa's bow slowed as she came to the end of the piece, suspended over the last ethereal high note. The sound continued to ring throughout the brownstone, long after the bow had left the violin. When Isa opened her eyes, she had forgotten where she was. The Biederman stood in front of her, his face so pale, his skin almost looked translucent. Isa took down her violin and found herself reaching out to touch his arm. The Biederman stepped back and lifted his head to look at her with miserable, watery eyes.
I'm sorry,
the Biederman rasped. He gazed at Isa and her violin for another long moment. Then he closed the door in her face. Chapter 21 Isa descended the staircase with heavy footsteps while her family and friends watched in silence. But the moment her feet touched the second floor landing, she found herself embraced from all sides by Hyacinth and Lainey, by Oliver and Mr. Van Houten.
by her parents, and Mr. Jeet and Miss Josie and Auntie Harrigan and Uncle Arthur.
"What happened?" yelled Oliver impatiently, pulling at her arm.
"Were you scared, Issa? You saw him, right? He looked like a werewolf, right?"
Hyacinth asked, bouncing on the balls of her feet.
"Are you okay, honey?" asked Papa.
He cupped Issa's chin in concern.
"That was the most excellently furie I've ever heard,"
Mr. Van Houten said, wiping tears from the corners of his eyes.
"I wish you would play like that in your lessons."
Miss Josie ushered Issa inside the apartment while Mr. Jeet patted Issa's hand. The only person who didn't have a word to say or a hug to give was Jessie. In fact, she had disappeared. After looking around the living room, Issa wandered into the kitchen in search of her. A movement out of the open window caught her eye. Issa stuck her head out the window, then climbed onto the fire escape.
"Hi," Jessie said. She was sitting on the first step. The wind and rain had stopped, but fat drops fell onto her head from a tree branch.
"Hi," Issa said, lifting her eyes to look up at the water wall. Pieces of tubing were torn from the wall, and two water wheels and all the wind chimes were missing.
"Damage from the storm," Jessie said, watching Issa survey the destruction.
There was a long pause.
"You were awesome up there," Jessie finally said.
Issa didn't reply.
"Issa, please."
Issa shook her head.
"I want to know why you did it."
Jessie swallowed, then stared down at her scuffed sneakers.
"I never meant to hurt you. I honestly didn't think you wanted to go to the dance. And when I found out you did want to go, I don't know, I felt like I was losing you. It scared me, even more than moving."
She finally looked up.
"Jessie..."
Issa trailed off before stepping closer to her.
"You'll always be stuck with me."
Jessie looked up, her eyes hopeful.
"I'm still upset," Issa informed her. "I don't know if I've forgiven you yet."
"I'll make it up to you," Jessie promised. "I'll cook Tuesday dinners for the next month."
Issa contemplated. Then she shook her head and crossed her arms over her chest.
"I've been wronged," she said. "I don't know if I'll ever recover."
"Okay, fine. I'll clean the bathroom when it's your turn."
"For how long?"
"A month."
Issa fixed her eyes on a point beyond Jessie's shoulder.
"Fine, 3 months."
Issa finally cracked a tiny smile.
"Okay." "Okay to what?" Jessie asked.
"Okay to everything."
Papa cleared his throat.
"Please, may I give a toast?"
When the room quieted, he lifted his wine glass.
"We have loved living here. I cannot imagine better neighbors,"
he nodded to Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet.
"Better family,"
then to Auntie Harrigan and Uncle Arthur.
"Or a better teacher,"
and finally to Mr. Van Houten.
"I have always believed that raising kids means more than just being a good parent and trying to do the right things,"
Papa went on, his voice beginning to wobble.
"It means surrounding your kids with amazing people who can bring science experiments and jam cookies, laughter and joy and beautiful experiences into their lives. From every part of my being, I want to thank you for giving me and my family the gifts of friendship and love."
Miss Josie cried into a lace handkerchief, and Mr. Jeet hiccuped as tears pooled in his eyes. Mr. Van Houten blew his nose into a dinner napkin, and Auntie Harrigan wiped her eyes with her sleeve. Uncle Arthur disguised his own tears by picking up Lainey and burying his head in her neck. Issa looked at her siblings. Operation Biederman had officially failed. But beneath the sadness, her heart felt too big for her body.
"We didn't win over the Biederman," Issa said. "But this made me realize that home is much more than a place.
She smiled at her siblings. It's good to be a Vanderbeeker, wherever we live. With the speeches done, Lainey ran around distributing hugs and kisses, and soon everyone drifted back to the dining room table, taking another helping of food now that appetites had returned. As people finished off dinner and started in on dessert, Issa cleared the table of dirty dishes and was on her way to the kitchen when Mr. Van Houten pulled her aside.
Issa, I must tell you something about Mr. Biederman.
What about the Biederman? Asked Oliver, who was walking by with a piece of chocolate cake as big as the plate it was on.
Are you talking about the Biederman? Jessie called from the kitchen.
Don't talk about the Biederman without us, Hyacinth said, pulling Lainey away from the dessert table where she was sticking her fingers into the carrot cake frosting.
Mr. Van Houten took the stack of dishes out of Issa's hand and set them on a side table.
I didn't know, Mr. Van Houten said, his voice lowering, that your landlord was Mr. Biederman.
The kids held their breath.
I knew him. A long time ago, Mr. Van Houten began. I didn't even remember that this was the building he lived in. He stopped abruptly.
We know about his wife and daughter, Issa said, about the car accident.
What car accident?
Jessie and Oliver and Hyacinth and Lainey said at the same time.
Mrs. Castleman gave me a newspaper article about it, Issa said. They died in a car accident.
Mr. Van Houten breathed a sigh of relief.
So you know about that. But what you might not know is that his daughter Luciana was a violinist. She was my student.
A violinist? The kids echoed.
She was very talented. Issa, you have always reminded me a little of Luciana, especially when you were younger.
Creepy, breathed Jessie. The kids nodded in agreement.
Well, I wanted to tell you that the violin you've been playing, you know, it's been in my family for many generations, right? Well, I had lent Luciana that violin, too. But then, when she died...
Mr. Van Houten paused.
Well, her father didn't want anything around that reminded him of his daughter, so he returned it. It's been sitting in my closet, shut away, until you came along.
Issa let out a breath she didn't know she was holding.
I thought you should know.
Mr. Van Houten's voice sounded as though it were coming from far away, as though he were talking to her from the other end of a long tunnel.
The Biederman's daughter.
Mr. Van Houten's violin. Issa's violin.
Luciana's violin.
Luciana touching the same wood, feeling the same vibrations, hearing the same sounds. And just like that, the story clicked together. When the last of the guests had gone, and Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's apartment was returned to its original condition, Mama and Papa gathered the children and ushered them downstairs to get ready for bed. Issa changed into her pajamas before heading to the bathroom to brush her teeth. Jessie and Oliver were already there, and Oliver mumbled something with a mouth full of frothy toothpaste.
What did you say?
Issa asked.
Oliver spit. I feel sorry for the Biederman,
Oliver repeated.
I never thought I would say this, but I feel sorry for him, too,
Jessie said, rinsing her toothbrush under the faucet.
I wish you could have seen his face when I went up there, Issa said as she squeezed toothpaste onto her brush. When he opened the door, his face was all red from yelling and being mad, but when I finished playing the swan, his face had turned so white. I've never seen anyone look like that before, like he had seen a ghost.
Oliver rinsed his mouth.
He sort of did see a ghost, the ghost of Luciana.
He shook his head.
Geez, that's so creepy.
That's too weird that she played violin with Mr. Van Houten, too, Issa said. With the exact same violin?
Did you know that violin has a different sound from other violins? The wood is so old, it makes this really beautiful ringing sound.
The Biederman must have recognized the violin. When Mr. Van Houten said the Biederman didn't want anything that reminded him of his daughter, I felt this chill. Now I feel terrible going up there and playing the same violin his daughter did right in his face, like I was throwing all these bad memories at him.
Jessie put her arms around Isa and Oliver. You didn't know. Anyway, it's probably best we're leaving so he can have some peace. I spent so much time avoiding him, and now all I want to do is make him feel better.
Me too, Isa said.
Me too, echoed Oliver.
Not too much later, the twins were alone in their bedroom, snuggled under their thick comforters.
I guess this is it, Isa said. The last Christmas Eve in the brownstone.
The pipes that carried heat to the radiators banged restlessly within the walls.
Do you think we should do anything else for the Biederman, now that we know?
Jessie trailed off.
Isa looked over at her violin sitting on her desk.
I think the only thing we can do now is give him what he's wanted all this time. Peace.
I keep thinking about how he lost his whole family in one night, Jessie murmured from her burrow beneath the blankets.
I can't stop thinking about it.
Isa reached over to turn off the lamp next to her bed. Darkness took over the room.
Me too.
Good night, Isa.
Good night, Jessie.
Isa lay back on her bed and gazed at the familiar sights. There was the crack in the shape of Eastern Europe on the ceiling. There was the light that fell in a long rectangle onto the floor between their beds from the street lamp right outside their window. There was the warm air from the radiator making the right side of her comforter toasty and cozy. There was the whoosh of a car heading down the street. There was Jessie, her breathing becoming steady and deep as she drifted off to sleep. There were the rough grooves of the bricks lining the wall behind her headboard. There was the whistling of the pipes in the walls of the brownstone. There was the sound of her parents' low murmuring as they climbed the stairs and quietly peeked into the kids' bedrooms. There was the sound of a distant car alarm and a dog's bark. This was home. And soon there would be goodbye. Wednesday, December 25th. Chapter 22. Oliver was the first to wake up. He had never outgrown the habit of getting up early to scope out the gift situation under the tree on Christmas morning. He crept downstairs, avoiding the squeaky step, and glanced at Papa, who was snoring on the couch, to which he had been displaced since Uncle Arthur and Auntie Harrigan had taken his room and Mama had bunked with Lainey and Hyacinth. Satisfied that Papa was sound asleep, Oliver searched under the tree for gift tags that had his name. There was a compact, heavy box from his parents, which he assumed was a boxed set of books, hopefully the Lord of the Rings trilogy, plus The Hobbit. There was a gift from his twin sisters, plus a paper-thin one from Lainey. A lumpy present from Hyacinth was tied prettily in one of her much-adored ribbons. Oliver looked at the presents from his family, and a strange feeling settled over him. It was a newish feeling. He had felt it the day before when Papa had scolded him and his sisters for the way they had treated the Biederman. He looked at his offerings, hand sanitizer and rubber bands, and an old piece of candy all wrapped messily in tired newsprint. He hardly felt proud of them. Nothing like the books his parents had chosen for him, or the bizarre knitting he was sure Hyacinth had spent hours working on. Those presents had love in them. His presence had, well, nothing. Oliver scooped up the presents he had planned to give and ran upstairs to his bedroom. He dumped the gifts in the trash, took out 6 pieces of paper, and started to write. On Christmas morning, Jessie opened her eyes and was relieved to find herself in her own bed, in her own room. Across the room, Isa stirred.
Oh, hey,
Issa said in her groggy, I just woke up voice. What's up?
It's Christmas morning, said Jesse. On cue, they heard Hyacinth and Lainey burst out of their room and run giggling down the stairs, followed by Mama.